candidates based not on party programs or issues, but on personalities and promises. With malice towards none and charity to all, they do not evoke the image of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. This is, of course, not surprising, but it is disappointing. It is a matter of concern, not in itself so much, but as an evidence of the much greater and more serious question of the fractionalization of our government and our political system. Concern is being expressed with merit over the ability of democratic government to really govern here at home and function effectively abroad if this splintering continues. It is becoming more and more difficult to identify authority and to focus responsibility in our government and in our party structures. In a world that requires adaptation to rapid change, decisive action is becoming increasingly difficult to achieve, and certainty of policies already enunciated more hazardous to assure. It is time that we as a nation gave major attention to this basic problem. We should seek ways to shape and strengthen our governmental and political structures so as to promote the kind of political consensus upon which democracy depends, and to ensure governmental capacity to perform upon which our national survival depends. This is no mean task. We have had piecemeal government and piecemeal politics for a long time now. The founders of our country generally subscribed to the role for government that would establish a rule of order and a framework of policies in which individual and private activities would have wide freedom to pursue their own interests. They looked to a government of law, not of men. The role of government, however, was not just negative nor passive. They looked to government from the early days of the Republic to encourage economic growth through positive government action. National roads, postal service, granting homestead on government lands, and other public works and services. They expected government to provide a climate for development and to set the basic guidelines, legal guidelines, for economic activity. But they did not expect the individual's lives would be subject to detailed regulation by government. Quite the reverse. Hence, there was real appeal in that phrase of Thomas Jefferson's, that government governs best which governs least. By contrast, for some considerable time now, there has been a looking to government for the answers to most of our social and economic problems. This has taken the form of requests for more and more detailed and restrictive regulations. In addition, there has been an insistent rising demand for government to provide more and more services, traditionally the province of private, voluntary, and individual effort. Thus, government is being looked at not just as the source of the rules of law and the umpire to assure that their fair application, but more and more as a provider of goods, services, and money. Indeed, we're living in a period where groups organized to get theirs, so as to speak. The governmental process resembles a contest among these groups for who gets what and when. It is as though the old slogan, Uncle Sam needs you, was reversed. You need Uncle Sam. In this process, the pressure of special interest groups makes it increasingly difficult to achieve the kind of compromise and consensus necessary to operate democratic government. It is demonstrated in the field of domestic legislation. Witness the stalemate on energy. It is demonstrated in the field of foreign policy. where the Congress, in response to such pressures, is seriously limiting the ability of the President to deal with the key issues in international relations. It is dramatically illustrated in the difficulty of holding down federal spending, controlling federal deficit, and having a rational federal fiscal policy. The President's Ford fight to keep down inflation has run smack into this basic difficulty with special group pressures on and within the Congress and on and indeed within the executive and the administrative as well. We know from the experience of other democracies what the failure to recognize this basic problem and to deal with it can mean, not only in personal economic hardship, but in the demise of democracy itself. Our concept of the role of government is involved and needs to be faced squarely. The Founding Fathers established a representative government. They looked to the members of the legislative body to represent the national interest as well as their own constituents. They depended upon the ability of reasonable men to come to a consensus by compromising their respective positions or views. But today, pressure group activities have made compromise far more difficult. The power of such groups is exercised not only directly in the halls of Congress, but also by using highly sophisticated computer techniques to mobilize a flood of communications from key constituents back home, particularly in election periods. Under these circumstances, premature commitments on issues are difficult to avoid. Some other changing concepts of government add to the difficulty of compromise. The progressive elimination of and refusal to recognize confidentiality impede decision making. Another factor in our changing concept of government that needs mention is the development of local vetoes of projects or programs already decided upon. The role of the courts in this respect is also significant. Accordingly, achieving majority support and fostering the common good or majority interest has become difficult. Unless we find a way to consider local interests early in the planning process and to expedite decision and action, we face severe economic constraints ahead. How and why we've reached this overall situation is understandable. But a democracy must really depend upon a majority consensus, and vital national concerns must prevail over individual or special group interests. This brings me back to the federal government of today. First, let's consider the relationship of Congress and the President, its effects upon the conduct of foreign policy. Let's face it, 536 persons cannot be at the wheel of the ship of state. Before they framed our Constitution, the Founding Fathers, out of their experience with the Continental Congress, learned that Congress couldn't conduct foreign policy, serve as commander-in-chief of the armed forces, or provide executive direction of the administrative departments of the federal government. I trust this nation will not have to learn this simple truth out of bitter experience again. It is one thing, and a very appropriate and essential one, for the Congress to review foreign policy. It is another thing to try and conduct it. It's also surely appropriate for Congress to inquire into the conduct of agencies engaged in the gathering of intelligence information and that shadow area of clandestine operations. But again, if it needed to be demonstrated, we have now proven that congressional committees are not the vehicle for handling of confidential intelligence information relating to our national security, and are hardly in a position to direct intelligence activities. The relationship of the presidency and the Congress in foreign affairs must be one of mutual understanding. But it must not tie the president's hands in the difficult task of world affairs today. And this requires also a recognition by the people and of the Congress that not all the members will necessarily approve, condone, or support the foreign policy of the United States, as any president may conduct it. Congress has a formidable task to organize itself for both foreign and domestic policy, to carry out its grave and far-reaching responsibilities in the national interest. Here, too, power has been dispersed, and thereby special interests or the interests of a minority of the people have been given far greater weight. To find a focal point of authority and responsibility within the Congress is more difficult now than heretofore. Competition, overlapping, and duplication of congressional committees adds to the confusion. If seniority and the old traditions are not to be the hallmarks of authority, then some other means must be found. This brings us to consideration of the executive branch and the huge administrative machinery of the federal government. In the town meetings that I've been conducting around the country for President Ford, I found a universal outcry at all levels against federal government bureaucracy and red tape. Frankly, both Congress and the executive had better begin to do something about it. The number of forms people have to fill out, the number of permissions they have to obtain, the difficulties which they have in getting answers to their questions are stifling initiative throughout this country and building up a resentment that may well be felt at the polls. The people are right. Why should our federal tax laws be so complicated that the average citizen can't even fill out his own returns? Why should they have to pay someone to do it for them? Out of its complexity or fear that they may make a mistake and get into serious trouble. Why has the number of lawyers in the federal government increased 180% since 1970? Why has the number of federal government accountants gone from 47,000 to 75,000 in this same 5-year period? As a society, are we getting so paranoid, so fearful of entrusting power to anyone to act that we may face paralysis? This may be what has happened to our political parties. Our majority parties served a real purpose over the years by uniting different groups, encompassing different regions of the nation, helping to bring about a compromise on difficult issues. But they've been eroded by special interests, by candidates who owe their being not to party affiliations or activity, but to individual special interest identifications. We can meet all these problems. But first, we need to wake up and to realize that time may not be running in our favor. Wake up and eliminate the thought that somehow, some way, we'll make it with someone else doing the heavy lifting. Let's face the facts. We've been on a national negative kick for 4 years. We've been looking backwards, and we've been rehashing the past. It's time we face the future. It's time to determine our enlightened national self-interest. It's time to realize that the opportunities are there if we'd but have the will to grasp them. It's time that we all devote our energies to positive efforts for this third century. And that's what I'm going to talk about in the weeks ahead, and I sure hope others do too. Thank you very much.